Demonology and the Triphasic Model of Trauma, an Integrative Approach. A Good Omens fanfic written by NNM and performed by Starcatcher Betty. Chapter 13. Electra and Oedipus. You know, maybe we should spend some time talking about your interior design choices, she said. No, he said, glaring, but it was one of his more friendly glares. No, we're not going to do that. You don't get to look at my things. Uh-huh, she said, looking at his things. It was the start of day 3, and Crowley had apparently decided he was ready for a change of scenery. This was a pleasant surprise, and it spoke well to his improving mental state, although she could only assume the uptick wouldn't last the whole day. Aziraphale was gone by the time she arrived, so Crowley had opened the door when she knocked, and then invited her into a different room of his flat. She wasn't sure what to call this room. It didn't seem right to call it an office, or a living room, or a study, and she decided she certainly wasn't going to think of it as a throne room. She wasn't going to think of it as a throne room, even if, at the moment, Crowley was sitting in a goddamn fucking throne. Let's at least address the power differential you've set up here, she said. When she had arrived, the wooden chair that had previously been stationed in his bedroom was now on the opposite side of the desk from his goddamn fucking throne. It was too short. It left her in a diminutive position as she sat in it, and it meant he towered over her. He towered over her again because he was sitting in none other than a goddamn fucking throne.
If you find this uncomfortable, he said, then I have bad news for you about the rest of eternity.
If the worst that happens is I feel uncomfortable, she said, then I gotta say, Hal's got a pretty great propaganda machine it's running up here.
Ugh, he said, annoyed.
It was the start of day 3, and she was sitting in a too short chair across from her client in a goddamn fucking throne, with a behemoth of a desk between them. It was the start of day 3, and it was time for them to negotiate. This was where he had set them up, when he had known it was time for them to negotiate. She took the folder from her bag, and she removed the unsigned contract from the folder. She placed the paper on the surface between them. Crowley reached out, picking it up. He looked it over, acting casual, as if it didn't take a significant amount of effort to act casual while sitting in a goddamn fucking throne.
Now that I think about it, he said, and his tone had a certain droning quality to it that meant he intended to piss her off. I shouldn't have made such a big deal out of this, should I? Could have just forged your signature. Isn't that right?
She wasn't going to rise to that bait. She set her expression in a way that said, look at how I am not rising to that bait.
That's the sort of thing we do, isn't it, Aubrey? He continued,
his expression now setting in a way that said, but just look at how good this bait is. I'll shred the release of information soon as I'm back home, she negotiated.
Nah, he said, returning to something like a casual voice, letting the unsigned contract fall back down to the desk. He repositioned himself in his goddamn fucking throne as if there were any chance he could actually settle into his comfortable sprawl in a seat with such an unrelentingly straight back. Should have signed one ages ago, to be honest.
Uh-huh, she said, and now she really did feel like rising to his bait. She wasn't going to, though. She knew how complex Crowley's attitude was towards the forged contract. She knew that he knew that Aziraphale was the forger, not her. She knew that he knew
that she wasn't actually the one guilty of frightening Aziraphale, even if he wouldn't admit it. She knew he needed to be able to bait her and guilt her about the forged contract, and she knew he would need to continue doing so until he was ready to acknowledge everything he knew. He needed her to be guilty of frightening Aziraphale until he felt safe enough to admit that he felt guilty for frightening Aziraphale. "Let's start by talking about why this matters to you," she said, tapping her finger against the unsigned contract.
"Barely even affects me,"
he said, looking off to the side. "Far more to do with you than with me." "You wrote it up," she pushed. "You wanted me to sign it. You left in the middle of a session because I wouldn't. And now we both know I'm here now because of this. So talk to me about why it matters."
"Do you really hate tea that much?"
he said. "So this is how we're going to do it," she thought. Until this point, Aubrey Time had been very successfully ignoring the tray with a cup of tea, a bowl of sugar, and a glass full of ice that was sitting at the far side of Crowley's desk. It had been there when she had arrived. Aziraphale hadn't been there, but the fucking tea had been. "It bothers you that I don't drink it," she said simply.
"Well, it's just..."
Crowley rolled his head against the back of his goddamn fucking throne, bringing his gaze back to her.
"It's the third time, isn't it?"
"Day 3, she agreed.
3 times you've come into my home. 3 times Aziraphale has made you a cup of tea because he wants you to be comfortable, because he's trying to be hospitable. 3 times you've rejected him."
She noticed his wording. He did not say she had rejected it. He did not say she had rejected the tea. He said that she had rejected him, Aziraphale. She noticed that, and she knew to be careful because of it.
"Almost feels like something symbolic, doesn't it?"
he asked the smarmy asshole. "I never asked for the tea," she said, shifting in her seat so she could cross one leg over the other. "You did."
"You know what I think,"
he said, as if he hadn't heard her.
"I think if I had made the tea, you wouldn't be so stubborn about it."
This was, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, getting obnoxious. She had come to this stifling, too dark, too walled, demonic lair, and she had committed herself to accepting nothing, not a thing, not even a single arrow. She had come into this space that felt like a lie, that felt like lies settled on top of deeper lies. This space filled with straight-backed, goddamned fucking thrones. This space where it was so easy to see how terrified and hidden Crowley had spent literal millennia, and she had committed herself to being open and honest. Truly open and honest. She had come into this space to do her job, to fulfill her professional responsibilities, to offer what care she could to her client, and to do so through the tool of open and honest interaction. She knew that she had, quote-unquote, control issues, and she knew these control issues could get in the way of her open and honest interactions with her clients. She knew she hated how much control she had to cede in order to sit in another's home, to do her work in a space where she didn't make the rules, where she wasn't the one who got to invite others in, where she didn't have to have her chairs and her clock. She had enough insight to know that it made her uncomfortable when Aziraphale was hospitable, was kind, was someone who could offer to provide care when she was the one professionally situated to do the work of caring for others. She had enough insight to know, to acknowledge, to admit to herself, if Crowley had been the one who made the tea, then sure, she would have ignored the protests from her control issues and accepted it as an act of kindness that it was. She could admit it. She would admit it. she would be open and honest. Fuck it, she thought. She reached for the cup of tea and she downed it like a shot. Several different signals from Aubrey Time's sensory nervous system were produced and interpreted simultaneously. There were signals from the hand that had grabbed hold of the cup, signaling which her brain interpreted as error, stop, reevaluate. These signals, unfortunately, were interrupted no earlier than the signal arriving from her esophagus that were interpreted dying, dying, you are dying, burning up, burning, poisoned, you've been poisoned. There was then a quarter second lag until signals from her mouth, her tongue, and her lips could catch up, offering a chorus, fire, fire, we're on fire. Then more signals came in from her throat and the whole of her chest, signals that left with her a choking, consuming ache, a sensation of embodied horror. She was coughing and choking, and her lungs were boiling, and she had just barely enough wherewithal to look up at Crowley in her panic. She looked at Crowley as she coughed and choked, and she saw that he looked near horrified back at her. "What did you do?" he cried out. She coughed. She spluttered. "You can't chug tea!" echoed from her coughing throat. "Hot!" "Of course it's hot! It's tea! What were you expecting?" She coughed and she spluttered, and now she glared. "Sitting there," she croaked, and then she coughed some more. "At least a half hour!" "He left hours ago, Aubrey." He didn't get up. He didn't move at all, and he didn't have the decency to hide how exasperated he was finding her to be. "You think he would just let your tea get cold?" She glowered, and then she glowered some more, and she kept on glowering while she tried to get her throat to stop constricting, her lungs to stop spasming. "You all right?" he asked.
"No."
It came out as a choked-off breath, even though she had meant it to sound a lot more annoyed. He shouldn't have had to ask. At least he had the decency, she thought, to look like he knew he shouldn't have had to ask. He made a wave of his hand, like a quick shoo away of a fly, and then she felt the pain recede. She felt her system start to calm. She waited for the sense memory of the psychological panic to pass. She took deep breaths. What a pleasant surprise, she thought, to find herself grateful for a full glass of ice. She scooped out a cube from the glass on the tea tray and popped it in her mouth. "Thank you, Aziraphale," she made herself think. "You're an idiot," Crowley said. He said it, and she saw that he was starting to grin. "Listen," she said around the ice with her most powerful glare. "You can either laugh at me, or you can sit in that goddamn fucking throne, but there is no way I am putting up with doing both." He proved her wrong. He laughed, right there, while sitting in the goddamn fucking throne. It would be a while yet until her embarrassment was soothed enough for her to stop acting annoyed. But at least she could admit that it was good to hear him laugh. "You can't blame Aziraphale for that," he said. "I know, I know. I get it. You could have really hurt yourself there, you know."
"I did really hurt myself."
"So, tell me about this counteroffer," he said. He was ready to negotiate. By the time her lunch break had come around, they had a set of mutually agreeable terms and conditions drafted up. She had let him take the reins on crafting the specifics. Neither of them were lawyers, after all, but she knew his skill set was far more lawyer-adjacent than hers. And she had understood that, in this situation, what mattered for Crowley was far less the actual content of the contract they ultimately worked out, but instead the act of negotiating through it. Together. What mattered for Crowley was that she was taking it seriously. What mattered was that they took each other seriously while developing a set of ground rules for moving forward.
By the time they reached 11 a.m., by the time she left for her lunch, she and Crowley had each picked up a pen and signed on the dotted line.
By the time she returned from her lunch, he was back in bed. He was back in bed and he stared with half-hollow eyes as she pulled the wooden chair back into the room. It was okay. It was okay, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, that he was back in bed, that he had crashed back down. She had expected it, and she had prepared for it, and she was there to keep him from crashing down too far. By the time she was ready to leave that afternoon, she had at least gotten him to agree to a plan for the next day. He had agreed he would leave his flat the next day, the fourth day. He had agreed he would return to the hard work of taking care of himself the next day. She and Crowley, they had reached an agreement. It was 4 p.m. exactly that afternoon when Aubrey Time left Crowley's flat. It was 4:02 p.m. that afternoon when she ran into Aziraphale outside. He was returning, she assumed, because she was leaving. Three times he had made for her a cup of tea. Three times he had offered her a gift of hospitality and kindness. And the third time, when she had accepted it, that gesture had burned her from the inside out. It had burned her from the inside out, but it hadn't been his fault. "Good afternoon," she greeted him. "Yes, it is," he said, smiling a greeting back to her. It was now 4:03 p.m., which meant that she was off the clock. She was off the clock, but this seemed like a good opportunity to fulfill a professional responsibility or two. During intensive in-home therapy, a professional like Aubrey Time knew she was never actually off the clock. "How have you been holding up?" she asked. She asked while making herself attend to his face, to those expressive eyes and that smile that could still frighten her. She wanted to watch him carefully as he responded because she knew, while he was not a liar like Crowley, he had his own distinct challenges with the truth. "It does seem we're on the up and up now, doesn't it?" he said. It wasn't actually an answer to her question. She wouldn't push him to actually answer. She wouldn't push him to be honest. He wasn't her client, after all. Sometimes, when Aubrey Time interacted with someone who was not her client, she let her mind drift to imagining what it would be like to work with them. Aziraphale, she understood, would have been a challenging client for her. It would have been hard for her to gain his trust, although in an entirely different way from how it had been hard for her to gain Crowley's. Working with Aziraphale would have challenged her to be a better therapist, a better person. She knew working with Aziraphale would have forced her to acknowledge how brittle her patience could be, how pushy she could be, how she often didn't like it when people were nice to her. She would have tried, though. She would have tried, and, she thought, she likely would have failed. Aubrey Time had accepted a gift of kindness from Aziraphale, and it had burned her from the inside out. She wasn't the sort of person who could help him. She wasn't right for him. She looked at him, and she assessed him. And she had to admit that she was not at all the type of person who could meet his therapeutic needs. She wondered. She observed and assessed, and she extrapolated. Aziraphale, she thought, would do best with someone older. Someone male. Someone who exuded a comfortable, paternal masculinity. He would do best with someone who had a non-direct and welcoming therapeutic approach. Who could smile bright and happy. He would do best with someone who could support and encourage him to lean into his joie de vivre in every way that Aubrey Time herself found cloying and awkward. He needed... Well, shit, she thought. In retrospect, it was really fucking obvious. Dave had a background in music therapy. She knew this because he still incorporated drum work into his practice. He loved his bongos, even if no one who had to walk down the hall outside of his office did. Dave had a background in music therapy, and he was an older male, and he had a bright, open smile that he obviously hoped was completely infectious. Aubrey Time thought of this, and she allowed herself to develop a string of imagined perceptions, a full account of what she believed could be possible. She imagined Aziraphale, hesitant and unassuming as always, walking into Dave's office. She imagined Dave giving him that horrible open smile, and Aziraphale responding to it in the way Aubrey Time never, ever would. That smile actually would be completely infectious for Aziraphale. Dave's kindness, his warmth, his masculinity, his absolutely fucking annoying love of the bongos, all of it. It would help Aziraphale feel at ease. It would let him settle. It would give him the opportunity to practice feeling at peace with himself. She imagined the first time Dave would hold out a small bongo drum, and she imagined Aziraphale demurring. "I couldn't possibly," she imagined Aziraphale saying. And she imagined Dave accepting it. Dave would accept it, at first, because he wasn't pushy. He would accept it and he wouldn't push, but he would just make sure the offer was always on the table. Dave would wait until Aziraphale was ready. And when Aziraphale was ready, Aubrey Time imagined, he would reach out and take hold of the drum with his hesitant, careful hands. She imagined him tapping at the drum, ever so lightly at first, terrified that he was filling the air even with those small sounds. She imagined him growing more confident, working to find a rhythm, learning what it feels like to be safe, even when loud, joyously loud. She could imagine Aziraphale going too far. She could imagine the bongos cracking and splintering in Aziraphale's hands. She could imagine the stricken look of horror on his face, and then the warm flood of relief he would experience when Dave just laughed and laughed. She could imagine the bongos being healed. She could imagine Aziraphale healing. She imagined all of this. She imagined it all, and it all felt right. It all felt good. It felt like a future that was worth encouraging into being. "You know," she paused, and she worked out how she wanted to say this, "I could get you a referral if you think it would be helpful."
"A referral?"
"Another therapist. Someone you could talk to. Someone who could help you with thousands of years of repression and fear. Working through everything that's happened." He said. He said it not like he was considering it, but instead like he would perhaps put aside a bit of time a few weeks from now when he would consider considering it. "Let me give you a card," she said. She still had a few of them in her wallet, left over from when she handed them out to her clients. She fished out one, held it out for him. "He met once with Crowley, actually, but I don't think that'll be a problem."
"Is that so?"
Aziraphale still sounded uncommitted. He looked at the card in her outstretched hand, and then, after thinking it through, he took it from her. "You'd like him," she said, and she was certain it was true. She was certain. She couldn't imagine a world where Aziraphale wouldn't like Dave.
"Well, thank you,"
he said, and he offered her a gracious smile. He thanked her, and he smiled. The way he did it, it made her think of how she had thanked him and smiled that first day, when he had first offered her tea, which she had refused to drink. Professional psychotherapists like Aubrey Time are accustomed to frustration. Their work can be extremely frustrating. It was often so mind-numbingly obvious what a client needs to do, but you can't just tell them what to do.
advice backfires. If a client actually could follow the mind-numbingly obvious advice you could give him, then he wouldn't need therapy in the first place. So, the therapist's job is to sit, to nod, to help him learn how to follow his own advice, even as she hears the voice screaming in the back of her head, "Just do the obvious thing. Just do it. It's so obvious what you need to do." It can be frustrating, deeply frustrating, to know exactly what someone needs while also knowing that no good can come from saying so. Many of Aubrey Time's colleagues, she knew, relied on an aphorism to help them accept and overcome this frustration. What they said was, "All we can ever do is plant the seed." This was how many of Aubrey Time's colleagues understood themselves. They understood themselves to be the planters of seeds. They could do nothing else. They could plant the seed, but it was the tree that had to do the hard work of growing. Aubrey Time, right now, had to admit that she had attempted to plant a seed, that all she could do was plant it. She had given Aziraphale Dave's card because that was all she could do. She couldn't make him call. She couldn't force him to be ready to make that call. She could plant the seed, and Aziraphale would have to be the one to allow it to grow. "Makes me feel like a bloody cabbie," he muttered. "Seems appropriate," she said, not looking up from her notebook. "You drive like one, anyway." "You know, you'd be a real pain in the arse for any demon set to torment you," he said. "You don't scare." "That's not true," she said, feeling lazy. "I'm sure you could scare me if you really tried." She wasn't taking notes in her notebook. She wanted it to look like she was taking notes, but there wasn't anything going on that was actually worth taking notes about. Instead, she was doodling. She was sitting in the back seat of Crowley's car, and she was doodling in a notebook. Well, he was tasked with simply driving and saying whatever came to mind. There was no way Aubrey Time was going to sit in the passenger seat in Crowley's car. She was smarter than that. It only made sense that the passenger seat in Crowley's car was, in fact, Aziraphale's seat. And there was no way she was going to sit in Aziraphale's seat in Crowley's car. So instead, she sat in the back. She sat in the back and she doodled, and he drove. "Aziraphale doesn't like my driving," he said. "Can't say I'm surprised by that," she said. Aziraphale, in Aubrey Time's professional opinion, was a worrywart. He says, Crowley started, and then he stopped. She glanced up enough to see how his jaw flexed before he continued. "He doesn't like how I speed." "Makes sense," she said. This was why Aubrey Time had decided they would spend the day with Crowley driving her around in his car. This was why Aubrey Time had decided that this day, their fourth day, would be a day in which they got out of Crowley's flat, away from his goddamn fucking throne, and the whole persona that space was intended to reinforce. This was why Aubrey Time had decided that this day, their fourth day, would be Free Association Day. Freud was perhaps most famous for his completely unapologetic obsession with penises and mothers. He was also famous for plenty else, though. In particular, he was famous for using the method of free association, or the method by which a client was prompted to say whatever the hell came to mind. This was the classic image of psychoanalysis, as Freud practiced it, after all. The client spread out on a couch, the therapist sitting slightly behind and to the side, the client speaking at length without interruption, the therapist taking careful notes. Freud had practiced free association because he believed it could give him access to whatever lurked within the deepest depths of the id. He actually would take notes when his client spoke, and he would analyze every single thing they said to the point of inanity, seeking out the hidden meanings the client himself could not recognize.
Freud would let the client speak at length, uninterrupted, and then he'd tell the client that what he had said, while free associating, meant he actually wanted to have sex with his mother. With Freud, it always came back to penises and mothers. Aubrey Time did not believe in the id. She did not believe in the deep, dark depths of the subconscious as some uncontrollable, unbiddable biological force. She did believe in subconscious processes, of course. She just didn't believe that there was any place on the map of the human mind where the best you could do is mark an X and say, "Here there be monsters." This didn't mean that free association had no value for a psychotherapist like Aubrey Time. She thought of it like training wheels of a sort. She thought of it like the sort of training wheels for the open and free discourse that Crowley clearly needed to learn. Free association is, after all, free. Free association could, she hypothesized, help him get used to the idea of talking to her, openly and honestly, without censoring himself. Without censoring himself the way he very clearly just had.
"So, where should we go?"
he asked. "Doesn't matter," she said. "We're just going to drive and talk. Just probably shouldn't drive to the bookshop."
"I go to the bookshop all the time,"
he said, like he thought she was coddling him. "You do," she agreed, because she was in fact coddling him. "But you don't go to the bookshop with me in your car all the time." "If you're up to it, we'll try that tomorrow. But for now, let's just leave that aside." He made a nod of acquiescence, and then he made it a U-turn. For the process of free association, the therapist should primarily remain silent. The therapist should allow herself to drift into the background so that the client is as free from distractions as possible. Additionally, for the process of free association, the client is expected to be in a quiet and peaceful room, rather than driving through the hectic and crowded streets of London. But Aubrey Time made allowances for Crowley's distinct nature and need. If she didn't respond to what he said, at least a bit, then he would grow suspicious that she was doing something Freudian. If she had him try to free associate in a quiet and peaceful room, she knew he would grow fidgety and restless. It wouldn't have worked. So here they were. He could go as fast as he wanted. He could let the process of driving keep him from growing restlessness. He could let the speed and the free choice of where to drive help shake at the depression that still lingered on him. And she could pretend to be quiet primarily because she was busy taking notes. So far, this morning, she had learned that Crowley had a lot to say about marsupials. That was fine. Free association was supposed to be free, and they had plenty of time. "You ever watch Planet Earth?" he asked. "Parts of it," she said.
"Did you see the bit with the snow monkeys?"
Ah, so now they were off marsupials and on to snow monkeys. Aubrey Time doodled by drawing lines. She tried to draw straight lines. Straight, vertical, parallel lines drawn between the spaced outlines on the paper, as precise as she could make them. It wasn't easy, not while sitting in the back seat of a bumpy car. That was part of the challenge. That was the point, to get the lines as perfect as possible, despite her circumstances.
"Creepy little hands is all," he said.
She hadn't quite caught everything he had said about snow monkeys. She could agree, though. They had creepy little hands.
"Made in her image,
she said, to which Crowley responded with a variety of annoyed mutterings. Once she had a full row of straight vertical lines, she would then switch to drawing precisely straight horizontal lines, connecting together the vertical lines she had drawn. It was easier to keep these straight because they were shorter, but it was much harder to keep them perfectly spaced out, evenly distributed between the vertical lines. She was just about to finish a set of horizontal lines when she noted that Crowley had been silent for a bit. She didn't look up from her doodles, but she recentered her attention on him.
Maybe I should apologize, he said.
He said it low. He said it quiet. He said it like the scared and abandoned child she had always seen him as. She said it like he was frightened someone might hear him. He said it like he was frightened he might hear himself. This wasn't about snow monkeys. Her mind had drifted just a bit with her doodling, but she was certain he hadn't been talking about anything other than snow monkeys for a while. He had allowed his mind to drift in that momentary silence, and now he was on to something else. He was considering whether to apologize, which of course left him frightened and nervous, but she had no clue about what or to whom he was considering. She couldn't just come out and say she didn't know what he was talking about. He would use that as an excuse to be distracted. He would start whining at her, complaining about everything. She also couldn't just say nothing, though, because she was fairly certain his brain would quickly return him to less terrifying topics if he received no prompting.
"Tell me about that," she said. The oldest standby in the therapist book, that is.
I could try, at least.
He didn't seem sure.
You could try to apologize.
Never could have before.
She glanced up at him, and she could see how his hands were gripping at the steering wheel. His fingers gripped at it and then released, hovered just over it, and then gripped at it again.
Couldn't even consider it before. Wasn't an option.
Aubrey Time watched him carefully. She watched him carefully as his hands gripped and released at the steering wheel. She watched him carefully because she thought she was starting to understand what he was talking about, but she was going to be careful that she wasn't wrong.
"What would that mean for you?" she said, soft, hopefully unobtrusive. "If you were to apologize."
His hands gripped and released at the steering wheel. Gripped and released.
"Nothing," he said, and bitterness crept into his voice.
His hands gripped and released, and she could see how his jaw was working, how his face couldn't decide whether to sneer or do something else. He was angry, and he was depressed, and he desperately wanted to bargain for forgiveness with someone who was never willing to negotiate. He was feeling all of it at once, because these sorts of feelings always come together, always come packed together.
"Nothing," she repeated after him.
"She doesn't listen," he said. "She never listens, never. Could scream until I discorporated and she wouldn't listen."
He needed to scream, she thought. She had never heard him scream. Not really scream, and she thought that he could use it.
"Why don't we pull over?" she offered, still quiet, still soothing, but also noticing how the car was starting to drift into an oncoming lane.
He pulled over. He stopped driving, but his hands remained on the steering wheel, and the car did not turn off.
"You can't force someone to accept an apology," she said after a moment. "You can't make someone listen, even if you know they should. Which is why the real question is, what would it mean for you if you were to do it?" He sighed. His hands fell into his lap. He looked out his side window, and then he leaned forward to rest his head against the steering wheel. He needed to scream and he needed to cry. He still so much needed to cry.
"It would have to be something you did for you," she went on. "It would have to be something that was meaningful and important for you, even if you don't get a response." She could let those words hang in the air for as long as he needed them. She could wait in the back seat of his car while he took as much time as he needed, as he found all the ways in which he still needed to cry and scream.
"I didn't mean to fall," he said.
He said it as he had said it before, as he had heard him say it before, as she had apparently never cared enough to hear him say it before. Aubrey Time did not know why Crowley had fallen. She knew what he had said about it in the past, but she did not know what had actually happened. He had made allusions here and there. He had offered half explanations now and then. But they never lined up. They didn't fit together. His story changed each time. It made him sound like a liar, but she knew better than that. She knew Crowley better than that. Crowley's story didn't change because he was a liar, not because he was trying to deceive her. It changed instead because he didn't actually know why he fell. He didn't know. His story changed because he couldn't understand it, because he only had fragments of an understanding, and he didn't know how to piece them together himself. His story changed because she had never gone to the effort of explaining it to him. His story changed, she knew, because he hadn't ever known that falling was an option before it had happened. His story changed because he had been surprised by it, because there had been no warning, because she had made no effort to set up clear boundaries beforehand. Crowley's story changed because she had never specified what the ground rules were. She had never set out a contract, clarified the terms and conditions, ensured sufficient precision so that there could be no misunderstandings for any of the parties involved. She had never taken the time to ensure she had his informed consent. There were some things in Aubrey Time's opinion that were simply unforgivable. "I'm so sorry, Crowley," Aubrey Time said. She said it because he deserved to hear it. He deserved to hear someone say it. "I'm so sorry about what happened to you." A trauma specialist like Aubrey Time is always, at the same time, a grief counselor. This is because a trauma response is, always, at the same time, a grief response. There is grief in the experience of trauma. There is grief in the experience of being changed terribly and finding that you cannot inhabit the world as you previously had. There is grief in the experience of trauma, and Crowley would not be the first trauma survivor to think of his experience as a fall from grace. A trauma specialist, like Aubrey Time, is always at the same time a grief counselor, because there is grief to feel in the wake of terror and tragedy. The Kubler-Ross model, which holds that there are five distinct stages of grief, is by far the most famous theory of grief. It is a useful model in some ways. It has its value, Aubrey Time knew, for conceptualizing the emotions involved in experiencing grief. But despite its uses, the Kubler-Ross model of grief had its limitations. Aubrey Time, for her part, much preferred an alternative model of grief, a model that understood grief as a process containing separate tasks. According to this model, there are four tasks to be completed as part of grief: acknowledging the reality of the loss, experiencing the pain associated with the loss, adjusting to life with the loss, and finally, finding a meaningful way forward with one's life. This model of grief has not seen much alteration since it was first proposed. It has not seen much alteration except for the final task. As it was originally proposed, the final task required returning to the world and treating it as if it were brand new, as if it were wholly separate from the world that had existed before the loss had occurred. As originally proposed, the final task of grief was to completely give up on the memory of what had been lost and create, as if from whole cloth, a new understanding of how one's position in the world could be meaningful. It was this last task that had been revised. This last task had been revised because you cannot actually design the world anew. You cannot actually create a new life for oneself, as if from whole cloth, as if the loss had never occurred. You are stuck with the world you have, the world in which bad things happen, the world in which trauma occurs and the reality of the loss never fully leaves you. And so, In the revised version of the four tasks of grieving, the final task is put like this. The task is to develop an enduring connection to what has been lost while also accepting the possibilities for a new life moving forward. It is the task of finding meaning in the loss itself and having that meaning help guide one through the challenging task of living well. Trauma survivors often find themselves stuck in an in-between space, an uncomfortable gap between what was and what now is. Trauma survivors want to return to the old world, to the world they had lived in before the trauma. They want to return to that feeling of innocence and safety, that feeling of naivety, before they learned just how cruel and senseless this world could be. Trauma survivors often also want to shed that old world like dead skin, to reject it and move on from it, to create for themselves some brand new life, some thoroughly new world completely divorced from the old one that they previously knew. They can't. They can't do either. You can't return to the world that was, but you also can't create the world anew. You can't ignore the reality of what happened, of what was lost, of how much you care about what was lost. You can't. This final task of grieving, this fourth task of locating a meaningful path forward, requires that path to stay within that in-between space. That space in which memories of what was can be wedded to hopes and dreams for the future. It requires learning how to be comfortable with both what was and what can be, rejecting neither, but accepting both. It is only in that in-between space, between the world that was lost and the dream of the world created wholly anew, that trauma survivors can come to accept their feelings of grief. It was Aubrey Time's fourth day of intensive in-home therapy with Crowley, and he was working hard. He was working so very hard. He was angry, and he was depressed, and he wanted desperately to be able to bargain with someone who never negotiates. He was working so very hard to acknowledge his grief, to feel it, to live with it. He was working so very hard, and the hardest task is always finding a path that can lead to acceptance.
"It's not like I actually wanted to stay in heaven," he said after a while, once he was ready to start wiping at his eyes, once he wanted to get driving again.
"You didn't want to fall, but you wouldn't have wanted to stay up there anyway."
"You don't know what it's like up there."
"No," she said. She returned to her doodling, to her vertical and horizontal lines, to the parallel and perpendicular lines she challenged herself to keep as perfectly straight as she could. "No, I can't even imagine."
For the fifth day, they returned to the car. Its back seat wasn't really comfortable, but it was better than the wooden chair in his flat, at least.
"So, to the bookshop today," he said.
"If you're up for it," she said. She had her notebook again, but she was actually going to take notes this time.
"And you want me to take the same route as I did the day of?"
he guessed. "If you're up for it," she repeated.
"Want me to narrate, too, what was happening day of?"
"If you're..."
"I get it,"
he cut her off.
"If I'm up for it."
She smiled. "And I'm going to keep checking in with you. If you get above 30, we're going to pull over and wait until you're back down to 0.
He groaned.
She chuckled.
"I know. It's going to be slow, and it's going to be grueling. And we're both going to hate it." "Well, when you put it that way..."
They got to work.
He made it. They made it. He made it to the bookshop. He made it to the bookshop, and he went inside. And Aziraphale was there, because of course Aziraphale would be there, would always be there. Crowley needed the opportunity to appreciate, on a neurological level, that... one exceptional case aside, Aziraphale would always be there.
Aubrey Time stayed in the car while Crowley went inside. She didn't want to go in. She had been burned from the inside out by the act of kindness provided by that bookshop's proprietor, and she had to admit it was all her fault. It had been all her fault. Besides, she had to assume that Aziraphale didn't want a human like her in his shop anyway. It was better for her to wait outside. Crowley came back to the car, and they did it again. They drove again from his flat to the bookshop, stopping whenever he had to, going as slowly as he needed to. And then they did it again, and again. They kept doing it, over and over, the whole morning, and then the whole afternoon. They kept doing it, and by the end of the day, Crowley made it the entire drive without having to stop even once. She was so proud of him. She was so very proud of the hard work that he had put into it. She was so proud of how very committed he had been over the past 5 days, despite how easy it would have been to just give in entirely to despair. She was so very proud because he was committed, because he had agreed to her counteroffer, because they had gotten back to work, and he had worked so very hard. Aubrey Time was so proud of him, because he deserved it. The sixth day was her final day. The sixth day was the final day until she got to go back home. The sixth day, she had long ago decided, was the day they would go to a garden center. She and her client stood, side by side, looking out at a remarkable variety of plants for sale, as they were completely ignored by all the employees and other customers. "Let me guess," he said, arms crossed in front of himself, putting on an air of disgruntlement. "You want me to pick a plant, and you want me to be nice to it." "Oh, Crowley. Oh, no." She cackled. She literally cackled. She turned to face him after she cackled, and she gave him a very wide, toothy grin. "No, bud. Oh, I'm so sorry, but it's going to be so much worse than that," he muttered. "Don't call me bud." She would decide later whether she wanted to annoy him by continuing to call him bud. Right now, she already had far more than a sufficient plan to torture him. "You're right that I want you to pick out a plant," she said, still grinning, still acknowledging to herself how much of a son of a bitch she could be. "But what I want is for you to pick out a plant, and then I want you to love it." He made exactly the sort of sound she had expected him to make. She cackled again. "Like I said, sorry about that." She wasn't sorry about it.
"I'm not capable of love," he grumbled.
"Huh. Try again."
"I don't do love,"
he grumbled. "Once more. Try again once more." He gritted his teeth. He knew she wanted him to be open and honest. She knew that he was trying, and that he had been trying, that he would continue to try to find a way to be open and honest. She and Crowley, she thought, were going to make it to being open and honest with each other, even if it took commitment and time.
"If I try, then I'm just going to fail,"
he said, sounding out the words carefully through his gritted teeth. Bingo, she thought. She nodded. She gave up her toothy grin and let her expression settle into a compassionate and open smile. She understood. "Listen, Crowley," she said. It was a start. "Just listen." Aubrey Time waited for him to indicate that he was listening, which he did with a very subtle gesture from his hand while his arms were still crossed around his front. Once she saw the gesture, she went on with saying what she wanted him to hear. "Love isn't a state of being. It's not something you are or aren't. It's not a thing. You don't have love or not have it. It's not something that can be bestowed on you. And it's not something that can be stolen from you either. Aubrey Time did not enjoy talking about love. Aubrey Time felt like a hack saying anything that started with, love is. Aubrey Time would prefer it if she could never talk about love, ever, with no one. But she was a professional, and she knew her job, and she cared about her client, and she wouldn't let her personal hang-ups get in the way of her client's best interests. What love really is, she continued, after checking that he was still listening, is an activity. You're right. It's something you do, not something you are. But also, it's a skill. Like any other skill, it's something you can either be good at or bad at or somewhere in between. And, like any other skill, it's something you can improve by practicing. She waited again. She looked at him. He was wearing his sunglasses, of course, because they were out in public, but she could see that he was thinking. She could see that he was listening. She and Crowley, they had finally gotten to a point, she thought, where they could listen to each other. So, you're going to get a plant, and hopefully you pick one that reminds you of yourself. Get a plant that you think looks like you, maybe a version of you from some point in the past, in some sort of symbolic way. And you're going to practice with the plant. You're going to practice loving it so you can beef up that skill as much as you can. And hopefully, with enough practice, there'll come a time when you won't need the plant anymore, and you'll be able to apply that skill to yourself a little more successfully. Fucking cheesy. Talking about love. Awkward. The worst part of Aubrey Time's job, she thought, was having to say things that started with, love is. Crowley was very still now. He was looking out, straight ahead, and he was very still. He was breathing, though. He was taking long, slow breaths. What if I kill it? He asked. You won't, she said. She said it and she meant it. Trust me. He took a very long, a very slow breath, and then he shook his head, and he was muttering again. He muttered, just listen to yourself. Aubrey Time's eyes rolled before she had a chance to control them. She had forced herself to go out onto that really cheesy, awkward limb of talking about what love is. And what she had gotten in response, she thought, was nothing but derision. I get it, okay? She grumbled. It's impossible to talk about this sort of thing without sounding stupid and sappy. But that doesn't mean, oh, shut up, he said to get her to shut up. It worked. She shut up. He lowered his arms from his front, shoved his hands into his pockets. I didn't mean it like that. I meant literally, listen to yourself. Aubrey Time had shut it up. You know, every time I went in the bookshop yesterday, Aziraphale wanted me to go back out and tempt you to come in. Aubrey Time remained shut it up. I told him you'd rather gouge your eyes out, but he didn't believe me. He still wants you to come over before you leave. He wants to show you his books. 3 days earlier, Aubrey Time had been burned from the inside out by a gift of kindness provided by that bookshop proprietor, and it hadn't been his fault. It had been her fault. Entirely her fault. She wasn't the right sort of therapist for him, and Aubrey Time did not know how to manage people she was not positioned to help.
So I'm telling you, Herb, listen to yourself, huh?
They stood, side by side, in a garden center, being ignored by all the employees and every other customer. They stood and they looked out in front of themselves at the whole world's worth of different kinds of plants.
You stop by the bookshop this evening and you let Aziraphale serve you a bottle of root beer and I'll pick out a plant.
he said. He negotiated. Crowley was always open to negotiating. I don't like root beer, she said.
Good. Means you have some sense.
He turned his head just a little, and he gave her a smirk.
Do we have a deal?
Okay, she said. She nodded. They were agreed, even if her stomach clenched from apprehension. Fine. They both took their time standing there. They weren't in a rush. They could let themselves just stand for a moment, side by side, as they thought about the work there still was for them to do. Let me make something perfectly clear, though, she said, with a tone that he would be able to recognize. You take a single step over towards the herb section, and I'm out of here. He snorted out a laugh. I mean it, she went on. She grinned now. I'll go out and I'll get an actual cab and I'll go straight to Heathrow, right now, and wait for my flight tomorrow.
I get it, he said.
He ended up with a small specimen, something called a Zebra haworthia. It was a succulent, and it had striped, spiky, thick leaves. The specimen he selected hadn't been treated very well. It didn't look like it was intended for the sort of climate London had, and it looked more like half a plant than a whole one. Some of its spiky leaves had been broken or cut off at some point in the past. The remaining stumps looked like wounds that had not been allowed to heal properly. He selected this plant, and he held it in his hands. "Does it have a name?" she asked. She wasn't joking. "No," he said. He wasn't joking. He was looking at it, and he was looking at how it had been broken. "No, it doesn't get to have a name." She and Crowley, perhaps they could understand one another. Maybe it didn't get to have a name, but it can, when it's ready, she said. She reassured. She smiled for him. It might not have one right now, but you'll come up with a good one for it. He didn't seem to believe her. Love is a skill, and skills take time to develop. You're good with names, she said. She was off the clock at 4 p.m. that night, and she was at the bookshop by 5 p.m. She didn't want to go inside, but she did. She didn't want to have to look Aziraphale in the face and tell him she didn't want the root beer he had tracked down special for her. But she did. She did it, and he didn't respond by getting hurt or offended. He just wanted to be hospitable. He was just trying to be kind to her. He was happy to hear that she would accept plain tonic water. With ice. Yes, please. What was with this fucking island and its inexplicable shortage on ice? He was happy to hold the glass of tonic water out to her so that she could take it. She had somehow managed to make him happy. She had done that just by accepting his gift of kindness. He was, after all, the kindest man she had ever laid eyes on. He was the kindest man she had ever laid eyes on, and he laughed until his eyes welled up with tears when Crowley narked on her about the tea. Fucking sons of a bitch, both of them, she thought. And then she thought maybe Aziraphale wasn't so bad after all. Aubrey Time fell asleep before her plane even took off, and she didn't wake up until it landed.